Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, book lovers. Welcome back to another episode of the New Books Network. I am your host, Lee Pierce, assistant professor of rhetoric at the State University of New York at Geneseo. And I am so excited today to have actually my first repeat guest on, Anne Chang. We are discussing Anne's fabulous new book, Ornamentalism. And if you have not done so, I highly recommend that at some point you circle back and listen to the interview that we did last month with Anne on her previous book, Second Skin. Anne is professor of English and director of American Studies at Princeton University. And this book, it can't be boiled down because it's just such a fabulous book. But if I had to identify sort of its two contributions, the first would be that Anne is essentially creating a theory of what she calls yellowness, or a theory of the yellow woman. And as we'll discuss, this is very interesting because women of color has become a term that has sort of encompassed all of the marginalized experiences of various non-white women throughout history and in the present. But of course, that sort of collapses the experience of, for example, Black women into the experiences of Asian women. And those two experiences, in fact, have very different theoretical and lived entailments, which Anne parses out in the book, including issues of the synthetic and issues of the cyborg, as well as issues of who has the right to claim injury and how that injury is etched on someone's body. Although, as we'll discuss in the conclusion, that's not to say that the theory of yellowness does not have something to offer for a theory of Black women. And that's one of the things I love about this book, is that it manages to separate without isolating different types of non-white women. And of course, as a white woman, this is sort of an interesting thing for me to try to explain. But the second thing that the book does that's really fabulous is it is a theory of ornament or style, not as obviously, like, we're used to the kinds of theories that say for the last 200 years, people have dismissed style as being surface and superfluous and not important or superfluous. And so we're used to kind of reactions back against that. But the counter move over the last, like I'd say 30 years, has been to sort of reclaim style as this powerful emancipatory practice, and surface as the all. And of course, just as Anne did with Second Skin, this is a book very much about style or ornament as an entry point for sort of what she calls the subject, sort of without the subject made object in a sense, or the person made thing. And that style is not emancipatory, nor is it this thing that we need to reclaim the truth from beneath. Rather, it's a liminal point or a quilting point for all of these different ways in which traditionally marginalized and vulnerable subjects have to claim subjecthood through non-traditional means that are not available to them. So I will leave it at that for my quick summary. And Anne, do you want to say hello to everyone?
Yes. Hi. Thanks, Lee, for that wonderful summary.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a hard book to summarize, but you do your best, right? It's kind of the job. Well, it's so great to have you back. I'm glad that you agreed to do both books. And it's so interesting to see these side by side because they obviously share some definite themes, which I like that you make direct reference to the Josephine Baker book in here, because it really helps, I think, for the previous reader to see where the points of similarity are. But also, the theory of the Asian woman is so different. I mean, it's not the same theory, and you still yet manage to make it valuable, I think, to the study of Black womanhood, especially at the end with the Toni Morrison chapter, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yes, I do think that's actually really, I mean, that's what happens when you think about racialization as a process that involves style. You have to be, on the one hand, attentive to the specificity of the certain kind of racial forms or certain kind of styles, but at the same time, because they are style, they're transferable, you know? And so it's an opportunity to think about specific processes of racialization, but also using those specificity then to go back to a more comparative framework. So yeah, I'm trying to do both.
Wonderfully. And I think that's a good transition into one of the first things I noticed, and obviously I'm coming at this from obviously a much different perspective than you in terms of where I lie in identities, but you sort of insist on this term yellow or yellow woman. And of course, obviously this is an interesting move because you're not reclaiming yellow as some kind of emancipatory term like queer or bitch, mm-hmm. right? You're mm-hmm. right. you're insisting on it as a very rich theoretical concept, but you do insist on it. And I thought maybe you could start by talking about why the concept of the yellow woman and yellowness more generally.
Yes, I think so. First of all, thanks for this chance to talk about this book, which is, you know, of all everything we do is important to us, but I feel like this book is something that it took many, many years in the making partially because it took decades for me as a person to come to a kind of, you know, therapeutic confrontation with the idea of yellowness at all. So, but I think, you know, one of the first things I want to point out is that we say in our contemporary parlance all the time, Black women, brown women, white women, but we don't actually say yellow women. Why not? It is certainly not because the category is not relevant. I mean, there's a ways in which the Asiatic, the yellow woman in particular, is a figure that is so encrusted with racist and sexist meaning that, you know, we can sort of all agree on this stereotype or the symptom, but we don't actually say yellow woman. And I think partially it has to do, my project started with me thinking about why is this term unsayable, you know? And there's something about, and I think when I start thinking about that question, I realized, first of all, that there is, in fact, a lot that's unsayable or unsaid about Asiatic femininity beyond, you know, the stereotypical language about that figure. But also, I think there's something about this, and that led me to think about the ways in which yellow women have been racialized in a specific way, which is a very aestheticized way, which makes yellowness a kind of an ugliness. So, an ugly term, right? So in other words, there's an ugliness around the term yellow women that actually should force us to think more about why is Asiatic femininity, under quotation, protected under a certain kind of aesthetic term, and how that protection is itself a kind of denial or disavowal. So it's true that I don't want to redeem the word and recuperate it the way one might say, you know, queerness. But instead, I insist on the word in many ways to sort of force us to confront the ugliness of the term, to force us to confront the continual racialization around this figure, a continual racialization that, in fact, culturally, we're unwilling to think about, even if it's happening all the time and is so animate.
Well, and you make this really interesting claim at the top of, you know, and I'm not a Black woman, but I spend a lot more time with critical race studies, especially of Black femininity, than I do, obviously, in part because there wasn't a theory prior, but now I can also say that I am dabbling in the theory of yellow femininity as well. But you say at the top of your preface, and you ask this question, what does it mean to survive as someone too aestheticized to suffer injury, but so aestheticized that she invites injury? And to me, right, you kind of see there that that's not the same thing as what we've been sort of reading in theory and critique as what Black femininity goes through, but it shares similar sites. But this idea of the two aestheticized, but yet the aesthetics don't protect her from anything. So I just thought that was a really fascinating way to phrase that.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the reasons we think so, I mean, as you said earlier on so cogently, you know, there's this large category of women of color, but for various sort of political but also, you know, for me in the academic world, academic reasons, that category is mostly dominated by, you know, various kinds of feminisms. You know, there are whole bodies of literature on French feminism, white feminism, Black feminism, but there is no such theoretical body of work around Asiatic femininity. And that is part of what I'm trying to speak to. This book is an invitation for others to start thinking about this category within, you know, the world of feminism at large. So it's you know, this is definitely not the only theory out there to be had about Asiatic femininity, but I'm hoping at least it is the beginning, you at least invite conversations and the beginning of other people thinking through these issues. And I think one of the most interesting and intriguing and problematic aspect of Asiatic femininity is precisely its intimate relationship to aesthetics and its intimate relationship to a certain kind of objectification. And so, you know, in the history of racism, it's very clear that we're often looking at the ways in which people have been turned into things, chattel slavery being the most egregious and obvious example. But I think there's also been a history of the ways in which things have been turned into persons, and that we haven't talked about as much. And that, I think, speaks more to a certain kind of racialization around Asiaticness, the ways in which things have been taken to stand in for people, things from silk to porcelain, to tea even, you know. So I think that this is, I want to think about this as a contribution to the larger field of feminist theorization with a very particular focus on a particular kind of racialization that have gone largely untheorized, even if often noted as a site of denigration.
Yeah, I mean, and it definitely does that. It's just such a good book. Oh, your books are so good. Okay, so let's then turn. I mean, obviously, we've already touched on this idea of surface and skin and marking and the fact that you're kind of sort of pulling a chiasmus where if the previous question was, how has the history of subjugation been turning subjects into objects or persons into things, you kind of want to ask sort of like a different version of that question. Maybe not the opposite question, but another sort of
a compliment
brand
to
of it.
Right.
Yeah, a compliment, right. So, and that brings you to this idea of ornamentalism, which of course echoes not only the concept of the Orient and also the concept of the ornament, but also Said's theory of Orientalism, which is Foucauldian as well. So there's a lot of ways in which that concept does a lot of work for you in terms of identifying where your point of intervention is. But would you be willing to sort of lay out ornamentalism as the theory and then maybe how it intersects with yellowness? And then we could probably maybe, I guess, dive at that point into sort of one of the many, many awesome examples that come into the book.
Okay, sounds great. So I think first of all, I want to say that I did not make up the word ornamentalism. It's been around for a very long time, since the 19th century, used by art historians to refer to usually just a condition of being overly ornamented, right? But in fact, there has been a long history, incredibly long, from Plato onward to today, a long philosophic, literary, and visual history of conflating Oriental persons, so-called Oriental persons or Oriental character, with ornamental things. And so ornamentalism, when I hear the word ornamentalism, all I hear is the echo of Orientalism. And it is, actually no one has noticed this, or you know, this echo, this almost homonymic echo. But I don't think my noticing is so idiosyncratic on my part. As I said, there's just a long history of conflating Oriental persons with ornamental things. And so ornamentalism, for me, as a term, does two things. First, it just basically names exactly that history of conflating Orientalness with ornamentalness. But more than just sort of using the word to name, you know, I don't want ornamentalism to be just another word to name an old symptom. I wanted to do some theoretical work, do some critical work. And so for me, ornamentalism, I use it also to refer to the ways in which personhood gets imagined through prosthetic ornamental means, right? The way personhood gets imagined, whether it's legally, materially, or culturally, or even phantasmatically, or affectively, through what I call ornamental attachments. And what I think this, the importance of this theory for me is that it takes us, it does not deny Orientalism, which remain, I think, an extremely cogent mode of critique and just true, you know? But I think what Orientalism wants to do is go where ornamentalism, I'm sorry, where, see, this is something, I confused myself. This is terrible. But where,
a couple times I had to go back and make sure I was reading the right word. Don't worry about it.
But I'm hoping that what ornamentalism does is go beyond what Orientalism stops. So part of the problem with the discourse of Orientalism as a critique, even though it's, you know, an accurate one, is that it takes us to a moral assessment about commodification. And in fact, commodification and fetish are the two primary modes of sort of antidote or fight we have against Orientalism, the charge of projection and appropriation and so forth. But the problem with that is that once you name something a fetish or a stereotype, you actually kind of stop looking at it. And also, I think it closes off further conversations about, well, what are the afterlives of having, of being an object? What are the consequences of that? And so I like to think of Orientalism as a way for us to not deny the reality of objectification, but to explore the consequences of that objectification, consequences that are often terribly conscriptive, but also potentially might open up other kinds of other ways of survival that we don't allow for. So I like to think my shorthand for this is that Orientalism is a critique, but ornamentalism offers us a theory of being, a theory of being that can accommodate the interface between personness and objectness.
Yeah, and the other way to think about it is obviously chronologically, because you sort of, ornamentalism needs Orientalism, but Orientalism was a stepping stone to starting to think about these issues, but it 30 years later, it just doesn't have the nuance that's required. Yeah, it's, I mean, you do a great job. I can imagine if you were my predecessor, like you are Saeed's, I'd be very proud of you.
Well, you know, I was in New York, you know, in 2016 for that very famous, 2017 show called China Through the Looking Glass at the Met, you know, and on the one hand, the show was enormously popular. I mean, there were so many people going, I mean, with lines out the door, they had to extend the exhibit 3 months, enormously popular show. But there were also, of course, as you might imagine, a lot of protests around the exhibit for being Orientalist, you know, because it's called China Through the Looking Glass, but it's all about Western designers and how they make use of tropes of the Orient, basically. And so the thing that struck me as I was walking through that exhibit was, on the one hand, how extensive the history of Orientalism is, and on the other hand, how extensive and how incredibly still vibrant it is today. But at the same time, I was stunned by how limited our discourse is to it. I thought about all the people sending letters of protest against appropriation and commodification, and it was like throwing pebble at a giant wall. You know, the protests are all, you know, cogent and legitimate, but they seem to have no force against the compelling vibrancy of this thing called Orientalism. And I started to think about how, instead of trying to deny the abject condition of Orientalism, what would it mean to think about ways of surviving as that object? Because people do survive, right? And so, but what are the modes of their survival? What are the kind of ontological possibilities that can thrive in a situation of so much discipline and debasement.
It's interesting because this is sort of a side note, but when I was in grad school, I mean, really early in grad school, I remember one of my faculty saying that at this stage in my career, my job was to put containers around things. So it was to take a theory like, you know, like appropriation, for example, and then go find a thing that did that. And
that's terrible.
But then he would say, but your phase two, as you become like a real academic, is to find the misfit, right? To find how not only the misfit in the sense of they don't fit, but also the misfit exemplar that complicates the distinction. But so many of us don't. We just stop at the, oh well, this is hegemonic masculinity. Look, I found it. Or this is the panopticon. Oh, look, I found it. And
the problem,
right,
with that
no
is that it actually leaves those things completely intact. You know, in some ways, by virtue of denouncing those things, you have also left them intact.
Yeah, I heard a really interesting interview. Actually, it was one of the first interviews I listened to on New Books Network, and it was with Eileen Wharton. Oh, I can't remember her name, but she's an indigenous scholar from Australia. And for the last 20 years, this concept of settler colonialism had been really popular as sort of a replacement for the idea of just like post-colonialism. And she said, I just refuse that term because the more we use it, the more it settles the settler.
Yes.
Colonialist. And I was like, oh, that's so good. So yeah, very similar kinds of things moving around that are inspiring ornamentalism, but also it's a very unique theory. And I actually wanted to ask you, if you don't, these are kind of very specific questions, but I noticed that I think you published an excerpt or a piece of this in Critical Inquiry last year, Ornamentalism. And in that one, you gave it a subtitle, a theory of the yellow woman or a theory of Asian femininity. I don't have the article in front of me, but I read it a couple of weeks ago. But you didn't subtitle the book. Is there a reason why you just went for the simple ornamentalism?
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, that subtitle went to be in the preface title. The preface is called Preface, A Feminist Theory of the Yellow Woman. So I saved that. But the reason it's not in the
title. I do see that. Okay.
Yeah, the reason it's not in the title, actually there's several reasons. One, I thought that I didn't want to limit the audience to only people interested in the yellow woman. I thought the book has something larger to say about race and stylization and also because it's comparative. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I know it's cheeky and it's probably very impudent on my part, but I want it to stand as a kind of companion piece to Orientalism, Said's Orientalism. And I'll just tell you as a kind of a fun thing that the reason, you know, there actually is a book out there by an esteemed colleague of mine at Princeton called Ornamentalism, How the British Won Their Empire, Saw Their Empire. And that's one reason not to name it just Orientalism. But one of the things about David Kanadi's book, Orientalism, is that when I first heard that book's title, I was so excited. This is when I was working on this book, and I immediately went and read it. And I was really surprised that for a book about British imperialism in the 19th century in India, the word Orientalism never occurred in Kanadi's book. Like, he did not hear the echo of Orientalism in Ornamentalism at all. Now, it's not that surprising because his argument in that book is that British imperialism was never about race, but about class. So he just wasn't that interested in the question of race. But in thinking about my book, at first I thought it should not have the same name. But then I thought, why should British empire own ornamentalism? I wanted to reclaim ornamentalism. So, but finally, but not least, I have always wanted to have a book with no subtitle, with no colon, just as a kind of cleanness.
I really like it. Plus with the art on the front, which for the audience, oh, by the way, I should add to the audience, this is a really, it's this book is $12 on Kindle right now. So the price came down just in time for the interview. So if you're listening, I really liked it in hardcover. I don't know. There's something about this is a tactile book. I mean, not that literally you can touch it, but the images. I felt the same way about the Baker book. I was really happy to have a physical copy. So I would recommend this in physical copy just because the engagement with the images is so interesting. But
well, that's
the
one
cover
thing,
is
yeah.
this.
That's one thing yeah. I always ask Oxford, because especially for my books, I really feel like they have to have a kind of feel. And this one has both a sort of a contrast between a gloss and a matte. And that contrast, so the actual feel of the paper, of the cover, is important to me. But are you going to ask about the image? I love
Yeah, and the image, oh, with the title, it's just a beautifully done cover. And I love that they put, so on the, I'll have to take a picture of this for the promo, but on the spine, it's got your name and the title and the press. But then at the very top, it has a tiny version of the cover photo so that if you're looking at the spine, you still get the same image at the very top of the yeah. of the upper half of this dress with the red beaded collar
and
that has that sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I know what I love about that dress is on the one hand, it sort of captures something I'm really interested in the book, which is the way in which an object can have so much humanness without needing the human. So this dress is constructed in such a way that it can practically stand up on its own. And I also love that it's headless. It's headless and it has been chopped off. So,
well, I also thought it was weird, and I might be reading too much into this because I've stared at this book so much. But there are these four. So the dress is very beautiful. It has this beaded, mm-hmm. ornate. It's like almost a sheer mesh, and then the red beads kind of are more dense across the shoulders and arms and waist. But then up underneath the very ornate collar, they become more sparse. And then there's this sort of blank space right in the center of the chest. But then it has those. There are four squares, mm-hmm. of beaded squares, and then the one long, mm-hmm, square. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's a weird kind of cyborg quality to that, almost like buttons.
It is. It does two things. On the one hand, it looks sort of it's geometric in that kind of technological way, so that what you call me the cyborg aspect. On the other hand, and this is also why I like it, I think it also gestures to a kind of Chinese hieroglyphic. It's like a pseudo Chinese character.
Yeah.
Okay. And the reason I like those two is because one of the things that I explore in the book is the question, how is it that Asiatic femininity can be at once, at the same time, be something regressive and atavistic and futuristic? The cyborg, the artificial life. So that's one of the questions. And I love that you noticed that about the design, the center of this dress, because it plays on both that sense of the old, the sense of an ancient language, but yeah. also a future language, a more digital one.
Yeah, and I mean, it did a kind of work for the overall book that, for example, if Blue Willow had been the front, it wouldn't have done the same work, even though presumably you're looking at similar artifacts.
Exactly. Yeah, because actually that was the other image that was a possibility, the Blue Willow, but I picked the red one for everything that you just said.
Yeah, I think it's a great move. All right, so let's dive into some case. Now, this book, this cuts a broad swath, so you make the very astute move to go chronological, but in terms of artifacts, I mean, this book cuts across sushi, it cuts across novels, it cuts across museum exhibits, legal cases, contemporary film. I mean, it's a very wide swath of different types of text, which I really enjoy. As well as art and images, I own film and cinema, and I sort of am drawn to that kind of conjunctural sort of analysis. But also, you have the added benefit of it covering a century of exploration, which is really fascinating. So I told you, I was sort of drawn to the Piccadilly analysis as well as the Ghost in the Shell, but I think we could really start with any one of them. Do you have one in particular that you really like to talk about?
Well, one of the reasons to go through so many, the breadth of the project is I was really invested in actually, demonstrating the pervasiveness of this figure of Asiatic female ornamentality in all these realms. And so, it's the historical move is important to me for anchoring and see how the figure develops. But I very much wanted to make sure that we understand that this is not just a figure that we might detect in popular culture, for example, but that it actually can be found in the realms of law, in the realms of science, technology, in the realms, in various places. So you tell me what you like about the Piccadilly, which is one of my favorite movies because it's so it's so amazing a film.
Well, first of all, I really love the way that you read light. I think it's, I mean, part of it is it's just really hard to find incredibly good film critique because it's you have to have sort of a very nuanced understanding of what's happening, and you do this thing with film, and also this is going to be so hard to describe, but the way that you contrast the white women, Jean Harlow, I think Marlena Dietrich's in there too, and the way that their sort of shine is presented versus the way that that Anne Mayne Wong sort of shows up in Piccadilly. And then you also do this really interesting slippage with the word shine. So I just thought that whole shiny piece was really fascinating. And of course, it starts with that scene, the ballroom scene, where she's down on the floor and these lights are kind of illuminating in this crisscross pattern. So I thought the reading was so fabulous. And it really gets at this idea of the way that her injury is kind of codified by her ability to perform style in the scene, not in an emancipatory way, but also not in a way in which she's only ever an object.
Right. And that's the delicacy of understanding, the kind of agency that I'm trying to trade. It is not, the kind of agency that I normally think of as a fully intentional subject with freedom and liberty to express herself, but the kind of more liminal or limited kind or alternative forms of agency that one who is, in this case, literally under a script, right, can or cannot exercise. But the film, the film was very recently, within the last 10 years, re-digitized or remastered or whatever, it was restored. And I saw it at the Castro Theater in San Francisco when it first was shown, restored. And the thing that struck me, well, first of all, I have to say, very much like Josephine Baker, Anna May Wong was someone that I, for a long time, I did not want to go see. That is to say, I've heard of her reputation way before I have even seen her performances. And I hadn't wanted to watch her performances because I thought she was just going to be, another Orientalist fantasy, and it was just going to be painful to watch. And I wasn't that interested in it. But just like with Josephine Baker, when I actually go and look at their work, their performances, it is not what you think at all. It is all those things, but it's also so much more. And the thing about Piccadilly is that's amazing is that, it's a black and white silent film, but it is so full of a quality of light that you forget that you're not even looking at a color film, because in fact, it is such a profound meditation on the nature of light. And I love how light as a cinematic medium and light as an ornamental quality, because Anna May Wong wears a lot of bling bling in this movie, speak to each other and help us rethink another kind of light, which is the light of fetishism. Right, what Freud calls a shine on the nose, and so I try to sort of think through my way through these different kinds of light, in order to theorize the ways in which Anna May Wong's particular kind of charisma and embodiment and personhood in this, her celebrity, her persona in this film is constructed through these counterintuitively strategies and moments of disappearance into light.
And the work of celebrity too in this particular chapter I really enjoyed, because obviously you when you work with a lot of undergraduates, you hear them always regurgitate to you things that they think you want to hear, like, oh well, it's bad because they're a celebrity and we just fetishize and sexualize them, and that's always negative, and it's just it's patriarchy. And this is one of those situations where all of those words get used, well, except patriarchy, but none of them get used in the way that they get used the way you want people to use them, which is you use celebrity and fetish as sort of levers for thinking about what Wong is doing, not only as a particular subject, but also as kind of a synecdoche for Asian women, especially at a certain time in history. And again, there's a very interesting mutual imbrication between her subjecthood and her objecthood here that is that is very much an effective ornament and surface, light being one of those things that has both subject and surface. And so it's like, is light an ornament is kind of an interesting question in this chapter.
Yeah, and is light an object? When I was working on this chapter, I spent a long time trying to name light as a thing in the world, because it is present, but not, I mean, it's not material. It's not quite a thing, but it's not quite, but it has a lot of agency of its own, and I think one of the things that I hope that thinking about to shine in Piccadilly through Anime One, we can also get at a different, and this is part and parcel of the entire project, but to get at a different grammar of racial embodiment. And so that even though, Anime One is always known as, the actress who, the sexy, Chinese woman, it's when you actually look at the film, so much of her seductiveness or charisma comes from moments where she actually like hides herself, or behind shininess. So it's a kind of hiding in plain sight. That's really fascinating.
I'll send you the, have you ever read Eugenie Brinkema's Forms of the Affects?
I haven't. Sounds great. I'm going to write this down now.
It is fantastic. I keep trying to get her on the show, but she's on sabbatical in Poland or somewhere. I can't remember where she's from, but she has a reading of this horror film and the way that all of the grief and the tragedy in the film is not from the feelings that you have about the sadness or the trauma, but about the way that light works. And your reading echoed hers in a lot of ways, because you're doing really fabulous things with light. And of course, it's hard to even describe this to the reader, because even the book, you're limited to the film stills, which I haven't watched the film, but I'm definitely going to go back and do it now. But also you have to kind of describe the shininess and kind of almost the blinginess of it, the way that whenever you want something to look shiny and fabulous, you add all of this extra light echoing off of it.
Right. And actually the thing, the movies are saying moments when the scene is saying, look at me, when the actress is saying, look at me when she's performing. But these are scenes where you actually cannot see her, because there are moments in this film where the light is so blinding that there are moments, a seconds, when the screen just goes complete white. So there's these moments of So I was really interested in all the moments when specularity is punctuated and demanded. And it is at those very moments that actually the viewer experiences a certain kind of blindness.
I thought about that.
And it is that contrast that I think is amazing. And I think that contrast offers us a really powerful way or paradigm for thinking about the ways in which Anime One wields a particular kind of celebrity persona and subjectness that demands attention, but does so in ways that are incredibly, strangely, eerily self-erasing.
Self-erasing is an important part. Yeah, that's really good. It was a really fascinating read. And again, and to read this book, and I think to read it well, you really have to give up that surface depth binary. Because again, you want to kind of come back to like, what's behind the light? What is the light representing? What is the light? And you have to really get on board with, what if it's all just the light? Like, what if light is what there is, and the rest of these things we sort of construct around it because of the way that the discourses have been circulated? But in fact, there might not be artifice and truth in the scene.
Right. Well, that, on the one hand, light can be seen as you say, a veil that hides something real. But on the other hand, it could be, and that's what we don't think about as often, is that it disperses things. And so if you think about this kind of dispersal in relation to racialized embodiment, it's a very different way of thinking about how racialized bodies come to be represented.
And it's interesting too, because that movie is what, the late 1920s? But then by the end of the film, by the end of the book, we've sort of come to the present day moment into two films that ostensibly are very different from Piccadilly because A, because of they're almost 100 years apart, and B, because these are more sci-fi tech films, The Ghost in the Shell and Ex Machina. Is there a third one in there?
I also talk about Get Out because
it's a kind of
comparative racial moment. Yeah. Because these are all sort of body snatching.
Right, body snatching. And you're looking at something that I think, other than the fact they both have Asian women in them, you wouldn't link together. But then, of course, Get Out only really has the one, really you wouldn't say this is a film about Asian identity. It does have that kind of quirky little bitter at the body auction, but that's kind of still you wouldn't look at this film and think, oh, this is a film about Asian identity. And yet they have so much in common despite being so far apart.
Right. And I actually think that Get Out is really, I actually think Get Out is a very, I mean, it is clearly a movie about a plot wise, certainly it's about black and racially speaking, it's black and white. Right. But I think it actually is a very thoughtful film that Jordan Peele is very smart because I think embedded in Get Out, embedded within the black and white dynamic is a bunch of other racial ghosts in the film. You know, there's, as you said, there's that weird moment in the garden where the contemporary day auction, slave auction scene. There's the one Japanese man who asks a peculiar question, right? There's that. But there's also other moments of other sort of hauntings of racial presences. So for example, I think one of the biggest and most interesting questions in Get Out is not the question of passing, right? But the question of assimilation. And which is actually a notion that is much more linked to other racial groups in the U.S., whether it's Asian Americans or Jewish Americans. I think the question of assimilation is also invites comparative racialization questions. And then finally, but not least, I don't think it's such an accident that the instrument that's being used to interpolate and imprison Chris Washington, the main character, by Chrissy Armitage, a psychologist, is a teacup, you know, which tea and teacup, which is a...
What about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just hadn't thought about it. Yeah. Keep going. You're on a roll.
Because, if that movie is about the commodity of the black body, in this case, the ultimate sort of takeover of the body, the teacup reminds us that American racial history has been about a lot of other kinds of commodifications as well. And the porcelain is as you can see from the Blue Willow chapter, porcelain is a very imperial, fraught, racialized material. You know, from the early discovery of porcelain, the European and American desire for this product that for many, decades that the Europeans could not reproduce, it come to stand in for not only the material wealth of goods from China that the West desire and wants, but it also come to take on all these sort of affective qualities. It's cold, but it's hard. It's, there's all these sort of like discourse around affective language around porcelain that are, has a kind of anthropomorphic quality to it and racialized quality. I mean, this is why China with a little C equals China with a big C. there's a little like a confusion of persons and things right there. And so in that moment when Missy is in a way, it's kind of a subtle metaphor for the ways in which whiteness oftentimes subjugates blackness through the mediated function of yellowness. I mean, it made me think about like during Brown v. Board of Education, how the racialization of Japanese and Japanese American during internment was brought up in through Brown v. Board of Education. Now, legally speaking, oftentimes when there are adjudication around blackness as a racial category, yellowness get raised up as well. as a foil, sometimes, you know, usually as a kind of antagonistic foil against blackness. But just like Model Minority is a discourse about, you know, yellowness that is raised in order to discipline and shame blackness. So anyway, it's subtle. You know, it's obviously not a movie about any, you know, about, it's definitely a movie about black and whiteness, but I'm just suggesting that there are all these subtle cues in the movie that opens up windows for thinking race in a much more comparative, triangular way.
The Get Out reading, I mean, again, this is one of those moments in the book where you start off the book kind of with this insistence that this is not a theory for all women of color, because it's problematic for a number of reasons to treat them all the same way, and that this is a theory of the yellow woman. But of course, this is one of those moments where the book really starts to meet up with the fact that the theory of ornamentalism, which, as you pointed out, exceeds a theory of the yellow woman, it just is also the grounding point for feminist theory of the yellow woman, starts to match up with the ways that it helps us think about how black identity has been constructed through objecthood as well. And Get Out is this interesting moment where you see similar threads of ornamentalism show up, but it's not exactly the same because, of course, we're talking about a different racialized injury. And I thought your point about Mr. Tanaka, mm-hmm, I think is that his name? Mm-hmm. Right. And his question, do you find that it's better? Do you want to talk about that one scene? Because it's really fascinating and it's kind of interesting that you
I know
that this scene has one Asian in it the whole time and this is his move.
Right. That there's so this is the garden party, the Armitage is holding this garden party, which later we discover is basically a slave auction. And you know, there's one Asian or Asian American, it's unclear in the movie, you know, if he is Asian American or Asian, shows up, and it's a Mr. Tanaka. And on the one hand, we know right away that he belongs to the party, as opposed to Chris Washington, who is the object, right, of that party. But we also know that Mr. Tanaka doesn't fit at all. He stands out by being the only, you know, Asian character. He's the only person with a accent and therefore speaks in a much more diffident fashion. He is all alone in a party full of couples. So there are many ways in which he is it's very typical for sort of like the social status of Asians and Asian Americans in America, which is belonging, you know, kind of belonging to the white community, but not. So he's already this kind of interesting character in that way. But he asks a question of our protagonist, which is, do you think, I can't remember the exact words now, something, do you think it is more advantage? Do you find there's more advantage or disadvantage to being African-American? And that is just the weirdest question.
Yeah, it's something to that effect, right? And it's the only thing he says in the whole thing. And he sort of asks it in this very casual assessment sort of way as he's kind of wandering around this party.
Right. And the question is, more or less advantage than being white or than being yellow? You know, there was something so, and we can't tell, but he also brings out, it's just a second in the movie, but it really brings out the weirdness of American racialization when it's triangulated. Because there's a lot of what's confusing about that question raises all the questions about, well, are we comparing blackness to, what does it mean for an Asian American subject to think about blackness in relation to whiteness? His presence reminds us that what the West, you know, to speak very generally, what the West might want from blackness is a fit body, but what they want from, but it's not going to be. When reminded that what's for auction is not the yellow body, because you don't want the yellow body. What you want is a yellow thing. You want the teacup, but not the person. You know, he also reminds us that there's a whole other scenario that's completely unthinkable in that garden and in our world, which is how come the white male body isn't up for sale? You know, so again, you know, I think Jordan Peele is really brilliant, because that little scene with that little interjection with the one question from a solitary character who never happens again, nonetheless opens up, I think, this black hole of questions about American racial dynamics, way, you know, way beyond the black and white question.
Yeah, and just for the sake of the record, the question that he asks is the African-American experience an advantage or disadvantage? Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because I, you know, when this film came out, every student I had wanted to write a paper on it. So I read a lot about this film. And of course, inevitably, in fact, I'm looking at something, I think it's from Bustle. And a lot of people, this was just Jordan Peele tokenizing Asians and putting one Asian in the film because he doesn't want to acknowledge the history that Asians have played in racism. And this is one of those moments where the token is so important, though.
Right.
You can't just call it a token and assume it's doing just the one kind of work that we associate with tokenism. It's in fact as a token that he's able to do the work that he did, instead of, for example, just adding a lot more Asian characters in the film, which would defeat the whole purpose.
Right.
Another good example of like where, again, like you said earlier, reading the specificity of the exact way in which Asianness shows up in this film, not just reading the fact it only shows up once in one scene.
Right.
As if that's somehow a problem in and of itself.
No, exactly. If you just call him a token, then we miss the opportunity to think much deeper about what's being provoked. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Well, we're already at 50 minutes.
Really? I just so enjoyed talking to you.
These interviews with you always go so fast. So do you want to talk? I do love the stuff with Ghost in the Shell, but I also really thought that the opening chapter on the women, the Chinese lewd women coming over from the boat and the court cases that surrounded whether or not they were sort of legitimate subjects, not citizens, but, like kind of international subjects.
Right.
And you started with it, I presume, for a reason. So unless you have another thought, I'm thinking we should maybe spend our last few minutes there.
Okay, sounds good. No, I mean, I started there because I thought it was the, first of all, legal scholars agree that it is probably the most important habeas corpus case of the 19th century, though, you know, almost nobody knows anything about it. And the entire transcript is available at Amazon.com. It is an amazing drama. It's a drama of the visible and ornamentality in ways that are so much more complicated than when I first heard about the case. But reading this transcript was really amazing. So I thought it was a really great place to begin because it shows us the ways in which ideas of Asiatic ornamentality can play such a surprisingly instrumental role in legal adjudication of what counts as a legal person. And even though it is a very specific case about Chinese immigrants, I think it lays the groundwork for us to think about the ways in which personhood, legal personhood, to this day is a question and a construction that is often made around something abstract. Right, a legal person, for the same reason that we can treat a corporation as a person, it is because legal personhood is fundamentally an abstract notion, even though philosophically the discourse that supports it culturally is about the enlightened subject as we understand it from Western Enlightenment, the individual, the person. I mean, there's a whole rhetoric of personhood around legal personhood, but that's actually not legally how a person is constructed. So this is a wonderful case first to understand something about the specificity of how the Chinese is recognized as a category of people or not recognized as a category of people, but it's a seed for a much larger history of thinking about abstract personness as a characteristic of legal personhood.
And then you kind of have this idea of, is it ornamental personhood? Yellow, what's the phrase?
Ornamental personhood, yeah.
Yeah, which it was really fascinating because you use the case of these women coming over, and we got to talk about the stamp too. and the women coming over as this interesting examination of sort of like how a person gets turned into a subject and what the criteria for personhood is. And those legal definitions of personhood is something that comes from some kind of inner essence. And then that gives you a lever to discuss ornamental personhood as this alternate way of thinking how subjects who are literally barred from the law are able to claim some kind of subjectivity, even if it's not maybe the quote ideal one that we would want for them. And then you talk about how they were literally stamped on their skin as subjects, and yet even the stamps kind of weren't enough to get them recognized. But so they were in some ways marks of subjecthood, and then in some ways not,
right?
Because they had to be recognized.
Well,
as such.
I'll explain what I mean in a minute. But basically, they were seeing through something that was actually not there. They were seeing only via the medium of something that wasn't present, and then they were not seeing via the present the thing that's present that should be seen. You know, the reason, and that was actually part of the fun but also horrifying aspect of this case, was that the women were on a boat here. They were not allowed to disembark because the officials in California, San Francisco, basically said that they were prostitutes because they were women traveling alone. And the case went to court. It's the first case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. You went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But so the whole premise of around whether or not these women are actually prostitutes turned on the fact that about question of what they were wearing. So literally 95% of the trial were these white male lawyers questioning and discussing the question of female ornamentation, what kind of hair pieces, how, you know, what color the silk that they were wearing, et cetera. But what you realize halfway through the trial, and by also reading local newspaper coverage, is that the women were not wearing any of these ornaments because, you know, practically speaking, these are people who have been on a boat for over 60 days in the 1700s. They're not dressed up, you know? So what you realize is that, you know, for the entire trial, this conversation about ornaments was actually about invisible ornaments, ornaments that you could not see at all. But the invisibility of these ornaments actually allow all these legal meditation around what constitutes a proper or moral person that can be recognized in the eyes of the law, et cetera. And then at the end, you know, we discover that so these women were, in fact, you know, they actually have papers. They had travel papers. And when they were right before they left Hong Kong to be on this boat to San Francisco Bay, they went through all these interviews. They had papers. And this is before passports, right? So these women were actually stamped on their arms by the local American officials before they even got on the boat. So in a way, their bodies were the passports, right? And if you think about those stamps as the ornaments that are legal ornaments, but nobody actually, even though they were stamped and that's a sign of the legality of their travel, it wasn't recognized. So the one thing that was actually, the one ornament that's actually real and visible and legal was the one that the court did not recognize. So it was just this amazing drama of the visible and the invisible in a way that I, you know, when you read this trial, you think, you can't make this stuff up. It's pretty amazing.
You have a real knack. I don't know if it's just, that's why these books just take years, because you spend so many times digging through all of these archives. But the thread that you managed to pull across all of these very, very dispersed artifacts is pretty fascinating. And to that point, for the last couple minutes, we really shouldn't leave without finishing with your reading of The Choke Cherry in Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is the coda at the end of the very end of the book, because I could not have thought of a better way to tie this all together. So if you want to maybe reflect a bit on what the argument there is, it's not very long. I mean, it's a very small piece of the Toni Morrison novel that you're looking at, which is primarily this tree as an image, but also by the end of your analysis, it's not an image. It is what she is.
Right. So I really wanted to end on a meditation about to sort of gesture to the ways in which ornamentalism, even as it is in many ways grounded in a sort of in a very specific form of racialization around Asiatic femininity, that it has a larger stake to help us understand the imprecation between things and persons. And I think This is a very shorthand, but I think one of the most important things about Black feminist theory in the last 25 years or more is that it has taught us to pay attention to the flesh. And it's important, inspiring, but I think our attention to the flesh has also prevented us from paying just as much attention to things that are, I'm calling, the artificial and synthetic things. And I think it can be extremely powerful to think about how ornamentalism, to think about how personhood is produced and conscripted, not through the flesh, but through artificial things, can be equally, I hope, illuminating for thinking about African-American subject. And so I thought in order to do this, that I would go to Toni Morrison's Beloved, because it is understood as a very powerful argument for the flesh, because there's a very famous passage from Baby Suggs, who talks about how you got to love it, flesh that needs to be loved. And so it is very much a book about the flesh and a longing for flesh that has been horribly injured and scarred. But it is also at the same time a really fascinating book where whenever traumatic things happen, you also get an eruption of abstract synthetic things. She talks about she talks about, a cut under, a neck cut as a necklace, as a scar, as a necklace, or a smile under the chin. She talks about the horrible scar on the Sethe's back as a gorgeous choke cherry. And so part of what I think The Beloved is asking us to think about, in addition to the flesh and the question of the flesh, is to understand how the relationship between aesthetic ornaments and violence. And so I sort of do a reading of the ways in which the scar, Asethe's back, which is seen as this, which Morrison does not describe only in organic terms. In fact, she describes it almost mostly or primarily in synthetic terms, or at least non-human terms. She talks about it like a branches, leaves that blossom, like a wrought iron, a sculpture, a decorative work of an ironsmith. And so I think I want to suggest that it is through the figure of the choke cherry that Morrison also invites us to think about the ways in which our relationship to our body is mediated not only through our sense of our own fleshness, but also the sense of objectness. And this is the really harsh, I thought the harsh insight that the novel invites us to think about, that which is that a body that has been a corporeal, organic body that has been horribly abused and denigrated and scarred, that the way for that body back to itself may not be just a turn to a fantasy of a whole body, but that it might actually require a courtship of that body as an object before you can actually get it back again. So I'm not sure if that's that's probably not a very good summary. But the bottom line being, I really wanted this chapter to help us think through the ways in which an author like Toni Morrison is also meditating around this question of ornamentalism as well as of the flesh.
I was very compelled. Again, it's risky. It's a little bit uncomfortable. And I think that's a sign that it's doing the right work, your reading of Beloved.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable book. I mean, I think that's
And it's also a very uncomfortable book.
I mean, that's why I think Morrison is such amazing. That's why Toni Morrison is Toni Morrison. You know, like it's not, we're not going to get the easy solution to a problem that's century old and incredibly traumatic history, So thinking about what it means for a traumatized subject to grieve, you know, ideals about the subject, the human subject, is wonderful, but it's not enough.
No, agreed. Yeah, absolutely. And also, it's a racial ideal, right? It's a racialized ideal from the start. Right. So you have to think about the way that that gets coded.
Absolutely.
Well, we're at time. Okay. This was, you know, we managed to do it. We managed to cover all the things on the list.
Thank you so much.
So once again, I will. Yeah. Oh, you as well. So once again, I cannot encourage enough that everyone listening get a preferably hard copy. But if you get the Kindle, I'll understand. copy of Ornamentalism by Anlin Chang. And which actually just the 2009 release. So this is, we're getting this interview very soon after the book has come out, which is always nice. Well, Anne, it was wonderful to talk to you. Now you just need to write another book so we can have a third interview.
Well, thank you. It's always a delight. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much. And once again, everyone should, if you have time, both read Anne's Second Skin, Josephine Baker and the Modern Surface. Am I remembering the subtitle correctly? Yes, which came out a few years ago. And also check out the interview that Anne and I did for that book last month on the New Books Network. Goodbye, everyone. And thank you again, Anne, for coming
on. Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah.